From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. We've got a floating format for you tonight. Our main guest, Michael Tesserian, joins us in just a few moments. Happy birthday tonight to Coast board operator, not that he's bored, Dan Galante. He handles all the technical things, keeps us on the air. Americans may be too fat, but at least their cholesterol is low for the first time in nearly 50 years. The average cholesterol level for adults in the United States, they say, is at the ideal range. Results from a national survey that included blood tests found that the total average cholesterol level dropped to 199 last year. Experts consider 200 and lower to be ideal. Merck & Company, the huge pharmaceutical company, recalling about a million doses of a childhood vaccine after testing showed a sterilization problem in a Pennsylvania factory. The company is not aware of any harm to children who receive the vaccine known as Hib, which prevents meningitis and pneumonia. It is a three-dose shot recommended for all children under five and is usually given to infants starting at 2 months old. I've got to check with my daughter. She just had baby Gavin. Hope he didn't get that shot. President Bush vetoed legislation that would have expanded government-provided health insurance for children. His second slapdown of a bipartisan effort in Congress to dramatically increase funding for the popular program. It was Mr. Bush's seventh veto in 7 years. Meanwhile, he is asking for and may get $70 billion more dollars for Iraq. $70 billion. The deal would lack a key provision that Democrats had attached to previous funding bills, calling for most U.S. troops to come home from Iraq by the end of 2008. A Los Angeles jury found a biochemist guilty of killing her estranged husband by stuffing him in a vat of acid. A 47-year-old was convicted of first degree in the 2003 killing. Authorities say the two knocked out, there was another person, a former lab assistant, knocked out Timothy Schuster with a stun gun and chloroform, dumped him headfirst, still breathing, into a barrel before adding hydrochloric acid. Ugh. South Korean scientists have cloned cats by manipulating a fluorescent protein gene, a procedure which could help develop treatments for human genetic diseases. There is a side effect to all of this. The cloned cats glow in the dark when exposed to the ultraviolet beam. Some of these stories are up on the coasttocoastam.com website under Hot Stories. And the owners of a trout farm, amazed, a photographer caught their fish making an extraordinary escape on camera. They jumped right out of a lake into a 3-foot feed pipe, up, and swam down it and got away. Genius. In a moment, another genius, Michael Tesserian, joins us as we talk about the occult histories of Ireland and America, along with a little bit of Atlantis and some alien visitations. Michael Tesserian, he's our special guest, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Tesserian, our special guest, expert on the occult histories of Ireland and America. He has made the deepest researches into Atlantis, the origins of evil, and the Irish origins of civilization. As a matter of fact, volumes 1 and 2 are out. Michael is the author of Atlantis, Alien Visitation, and Genetic Manipulation. He is a regular contributing guest here on Coast to Coast AM. We go live now way out to the United Kingdom to Michael Tesserian. Michael, good morning out there.
Good morning, George. It's lovely to hear your voice.
It's always nice to wake you up out there, huh?
How you doing?
It's been great. What's new with you? Holiday season, everything else? Life good?
Yeah. You've completed the book, you know, so.
Like two volumes, too. Very well done.
Thank you very much. It's great to have it finished. There's been tremendous support. I mean, in fact, the book wouldn't be written without people's suggestions. So, again, it's pretty much the same story as the Atlantis book. I didn't personally, you know, conceive ever in my life of doing this, so it's, again, great thanks goes out as well to the people who, you know, is encouragement to put this kind of knowledge down in writing, you know.
Well, Michael, we're going to talk with you about a number of topics tonight. And I'm looking forward to this. I have been since you were last on with me. With the civilization, we have to talk about Atlantis tonight as well. But you know, when I first looked at the cover of the book when they sent it to me a few weeks ago, and I said, The Irish Origins of Civilization. Now, I did not look at who wrote it, okay? I didn't look at your name yet. I know when I see your name, then I know it's an instant success. But I looked at it and says, now, what am I going to do reading a book about the Irish origins of civilization? What does this all mean? And then I saw your name attached to it. Then I realized there's something more here, and there really was. Tell me, give us an overview, first of all, because people are saying, what do you mean a show of the Irish origins of civilization? What's going on here? So tell us why this is so important to everybody tonight and why it's a great topic for Coast to Coast.
Well, we have a great, I was complimented, you know, by Jordan Maxwell, who gave me, you know, the testimonial for the book. It's partly dedicated to him. And, you know, I keep saying to my audiences that it's not so much about ancient history at all. It's about what's going on in our world today. And when you realize that this war, that's, I consider it a war on consciousness, the various kinds of war, both subliminal and physical, that is happening in the world with this global elite, that many of your other guests have spoken of, that we talk about, this is a war on consciousness that is not just a few years old. It is not something, you know, of the last century. It's not something of the last, you know, couple of hundred years. It's something that stretches back to actually the dawn of time. So those who've really done their homework looking at this, you know, quote-unquote conspiracy, the conspiracy to darken the world spiritually, to darken the spirit and the mind of human beings, you find out, you know, to your horror, that it's a very old story. So this book is another attempt to show that this war on consciousness, this war on spirituality, on truth, on light, is very, very ancient, you know. And my job is to sort of to help to track that back. In a way, this book is the perfect follow-on from the Atlantis book. That's people who've read the Atlantis book will understand that I made it clear in that book that there was no way in the course of one book, you know, to track all the different machinations of these fallen angels or the Nephilim or, you know, or whoever you want to talk about it, that the people that I believe are very much at the heart of what's going on in our world today. There's no way in that book to track everything that they've been up to that would, you know, be for a future book. And this book basically picks up at that point to show what happened after this phenomena that we call evil came into the world. What happened after the fall of the great pre-Diluvian empires of Atlantis and Lemuria? You know, okay, if these, we know now for a fact through the work of the, you know, Graham Hancock and so many other people now, the people have gone taken photographs of it. I mean, we cannot debate anymore that the history books are utterly wrong, that pre-Diluvian ancient civilization existed. Well, the answer is, okay, if they existed, then let's start filling in the blanks. What happened? What was going on? What happened to those continents? What happened to man after, you know, they sank? And this book picks up from that point and starts to track not just the journey of evil, but the incredible story of the fall of the ancient continents, the changes on the earth, and the subsequent move, you know, of the great Atlanteans and these people with vast knowledge to the continent of what we would now call Britain, and their story of how this new world that we now know so well came into being, both in its, you know, the good parts of it and especially the bad parts of it. And again, as I said, tracking this story of the conflict between what I describe in the book as the sorcerers and the magicians. History, I believe, is, you know, may sound simplistic to some people. It's certainly not simplistic. It's a very harsh and true fact that history as we know it is a story of the conflict between the sons of light and the sons of darkness, the sorcerers of the world, you know, yes, and the magicians of the world. Well, let's get into the origins of that, because we, to answer your question, we are not going to understand the times we're in now. We're simply not going to understand this war on consciousness until we understand its origin, its roots, and, you know, what to do about it and how ancient it is, this story. So it's a timeless book. It's a book that, you know, yeah, starts back in the dawn of Irish history, of Celtic, of so-called Celtic, you know, Gaelic, Druidic history, but it's actually about our times, the times that we find ourselves in now, and the war against humankind.
Well said, Michael. Was it difficult to get the information for the two volumes?
It's been a very gradual process. I think that It's incremental. It's not so much about getting the individual facts. Any researcher will tell you that it's almost a mechanical. When you sit down, you know yourself, you've written books. I mean, your book came out last year.
Yeah.
You know that it's a matter of, it's a sort of almost a beautiful process in a way, you know, like a gardener bringing to life, you know. A plant, a flower.
See, whatever. And you're doing this all yourself. I had help with Bill Burns, a noted author, because without him, Michael, I never could have done this. It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, but, you know, I look at it as a sort of, like I said, first of all, the most important thing is it wasn't my idea, you know, so again, I have to emphasize that. You know, I had all this knowledge in my head. It's been an interest. It's been a study. It's been a hobby, you know, since way back in 1979 when I first got interested in it. And then I come to America and people are egging me on and saying, you've got to put this down, Michael. You know, they take my classes or whatever, and they, you know, why don't you put this down? Please put it down in a book. We'll help you edit it, or, you know, or whatever. And so it's just constant pressure to do it. But as I said, the main thing is the accumulation of the facts is a sort of a mechanical thing, and you just do it like any researcher does it. What's difficult about this book is the fact that it brings so many stories together. It brings together a lot of missing pieces that are not to be found in the work of others in this specific area of alternative history and the secret societies. And it's about trying to see the overall picture, you know, trying to be synthetic, which means bringing together all of the missing pieces. It means bringing together the work of the great people so that it's not just Michael Tesorian's, you know, newborn ideas. It's about the work of giants upon whose shoulders I stand. How do you bring the essence of what they have said throughout the centuries together, you know? And then also the most important thing is present people the entire picture, you know, the whole sort of lid on the box type of concept. And that is the part that I find was, I would say, guided. So this book is a very, very guided book. It's not something created of my ego. It's not something that's a book for everyone. I emphasize that. This book is absolutely not for everybody.
You really, people need to really have some depth and knowledge in this and an understanding of what you're going through here.
I'm telling you that, you know, I can really say this, and we've discussed it with friends, and they agree, that if you are not a person who can yet handle reality, don't touch this book.
Don't
if you want to live in illusion, if you want to continue with the old prejudices of the last, you know, 20th century and before, about the world, about religion, about government, if you can't handle the real essence of what is going on, and you want to live with that box around your head for more years, then by all means, you know, avoid this like the plague, because this is a very controversial book. It will upset a lot of people. It will also, but for those few people who are absolutely can't handle it now, because from 9/11, you know, I always say in my work, 9/11 may have shaken you up, but did it wake you up?
Yes.
That is the most important thing. And otherwise, you know, that terrible event happened for no reason. We have to understand that the times we're in is an age of awakening. And the few people who understand this, who are sick of the lies, who are absolutely sick and tired of the lies, and say, I'm ready for it now. I can understand that, you know, there's something bigger going on than we're told in the normal media.
But there are so many people, Michael, who will believe the lies and will be so vehemently opposed to the fact that any other possibilities could exist, go ballistic. Now, that is beginning to change. I mean, you can just see it in popularity polls, down, down, and down. But overall, man, when they will believe this, they will not let go. How do you change that?
Well, you don't, because you don't violate a person's choice to remain in ignorance. It's a choice, and, you know, it's also a choice to wake up. You see, it's not that people have been asleep. They've never been awakened, George. It, you know, when you say to somebody that, you know, the human race, my God, look at the state they're in, they're asleep. In a way, if you really get into it, you're implying that at once upon a time, the people were awakened, they fell asleep, and now they need to be reawakened. Well, in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. The human race has always been conditioned and controlled to be in a state of perpetual ignorance. We are now in the age of the beginning of the chance to awaken. We're a sophisticated, you see, advanced, literate race, group of people, nations, unlike our forefathers of just a very, very short time ago. We have the internet. We have libraries. We are, you know.
You there, Michael? Whoop, we lost him. Well, hold on. I think he's there.
Okay.
Yeah, there you
I'm
go.
I'm here.
I can hear you. Okay. Thought you flipped down there for a little bit. Now, you start this. Can you hear me, Michael?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. You start this book from the one on Atlantis. What about those similarities?
Well, that's a good point. As I say, this picks up basically the idea is that when the ancient world fell, that is when the continents of Lemuria and Atlantis fell, the remnants of these ancient continents, I mean, and it was an age of catastrophe. It was unimaginable, disasters that destroyed these ancient continents. And their story picks up in the British Isles. So it's in the records of the ancient Irish that you find some of the most intriguing and brilliant anecdotes about Atlantis and the pre-Diluvian culture. So this book picks up, basically in the aftermath of the destruction. We talk about in detail more of this events, the cataclysm, which is called the Age of Catastrophe. And we talk about how it was so severe that basically the inhabitants, these very wise elders that we know today as the Druids and their related groups, were moving eastward. So that the book's premise is about trying to show that, in fact, the elements of civilization move from the Western Hemisphere to the East and not the other way around, as the history books are telling us.
That's pretty dramatic, Michael.
Well, it's not really if you start thinking about it. And again, it's a controversial idea, so it's going to threaten a lot of people. But not when you see the facts, not when you understand, as we now are starting to understand more about the fossil record, more about the fact that there was these pre-Diluvian civilizations. Because as I stress so much in my work, you'll never understand the history of the world at all until you take on board that history didn't just begin, 11,000 years ago. And it also didn't begin when the early Biblicists said, which was 4,000 years B.C., we have to understand that civilization is many millennia old. And finally, as I said earlier, that we are getting to understand that. But now that we do understand that, that causes a massive revision of everything we know about culture. It's not that migrations of importance didn't happen from the east to the west. They certainly did. But they happened much later in history. We're now looking back to the time of the Phoenicians. We're looking back to the time of the old Druids, you see. To the Scythians, to people that are basically forgotten in history.
What time period, Michael, are we talking about?
I believe it starts about 13,000 years ago. That's about 11,000 B.C.
Well, that is way back.
It is way back.
So that's even before the pyramids.
Oh, yes, absolutely. This is before the rise of any of the Eastern civilizations. And the most important new discoveries, people like Professor Erlingsson of Scandinavia, who's a major heavy-hitter geologist who's now confirmed my work. He wrote a book called Atlantis and Ireland, confirming that land bridges existed. These are walkable land bridges existed between Britain and Scandinavia, Britain and the continent. And that these land bridges, George, were there up until about 2,500 to 300,000 B.C. So they're very recent in history. These land bridges existed. And now that helps us to understand how it could be possible, you see. And the early chroniclers and the early monks didn't know about these land bridges when they concocted the rubbish that we are now accepting as history.
Well, and you could trace the movement just with these bridges, couldn't you?
Yes, you can. And do you know that, we can grasp this now because even recently, like within the last couple of months, an enormous land bridge has been discovered, between Sri Lanka and India, and has been filmed from satellite, again, totally turning the tables on what people thought about that. So there it is in photographic evidence. And Professor Erlingsson has discovered exactly the same kind of thing, the land bridges. And presumably there was also one between Ireland and England. Now, of course, once we see that Europe, these divisions that we know as the countries and nations today, was not the same, at all as thousands of years ago, once we get around this idea that the map of the world did not look like the way it does now, and that possibly England and Ireland were connected by a land bridge, that England and Scotland may have been connected to Scandinavia.
Now this land bridge, was it natural? It was built by the humans at that time, and how did they do it?
No, this is just something that's perfectly natural, and then finally, went down beneath the waves. It's a phenomenon that's now accepted in geology.
Okay.
Yeah, and what it immediately tells us, or tells a person who studied these subjects, is that suddenly all those megalithic sites and those beautiful henges that everybody thinks was just built by different races and unconnected peoples, suddenly, doesn't look like that. So you're not talking about, some Gaelic tribe or Celtic tribe in France, some tribe over there in Belgium, a totally unrelated tribe over there in Germany. Once you understand that these land bridges existed and it was one big continental mass, that changes everything completely. And you start to realize the homogeneity of these groups and these these tribes that appeared to be separate, divided, distinct, you know?
Okay. Hey, Michael, stay with us. We're going to be right back with you. We're going to talk about some of these major earth changes and catastrophes that you speak about in the book of Atlantis. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, Michael Tesserian, as we talk about just some incredible things almost since the beginning of time here on this planet. We'll be back with Michael in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Michael Tesserian. Michael, let's talk a little bit about earth changes and catastrophes that you really highlighted in the Atlantis book, causing people in Britain to evacuate, to flee. Update us on that.
Yeah, this is central. The land bridges again come into importance. And this is one of the reasons why it is that throughout the world, you know, there is this dispersion that people like Glenn Kimball and others have noticed, that the elements of civilization bear an uncanny, you know, similarity. Now, in Irish mythology, it's there in black and white. One of the most important ancient inhabitants of Ireland talk about the fact that they came from not one, but four sunken continents or islands. And this is, why this is so interesting is because one of them in Gaelic is called Murias. That's M-U-R-I-A-S or I-U-S, Murias. Now, for people who've done their homework in ancient civilizations, that sounds uncannily similar to the word Lemuria. And, of course, we all know that Lemuria was an ancient continent, you know, in mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Rumored to have sunk beneath the waves. So here in Gaelic legends and the ancient legends of Ireland, we have a place, and if you consider the L being like the French the, you know, L apostrophe or whatever, then we have it right there in the Gaelic mythology.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the La Muria or Murias is one of the ancient lands that sank beneath the waves that these ancient wizards or these ancient magi, the elders, the people who are the druids, the ones who were the keepers of the great knowledge, the knowledge of nature, you know, knowledge of music, knowledge of language, etc., the elements of civilization. And these druids had already, after the fall of Atlantis, had a worldwide global network of colleges, mystery schools. You see, the old colleges, pretty much in the same way that the Christian monks opened worldwide colleges during the Dark Ages. And we know, you know, I mean, the movie, the fine movie, Name of the Rose, shows how the, you know, the cult of the wandering monk, it was the job of the Christian monks, you see, to literally go on foot throughout all of Europe preaching, you know, and visiting different monasteries. Well, this is overlaid. This system of monastic life is actually mimicked upon this ancient druidic college. But during the age of catastrophe that you're asking about, it wasn't a matter of choice.
And were these, were these rapid catastrophes or over time?
Well, they are succession. And the repercussions of the original catastrophe, which I believe happened about 13,000 years ago, that was, I believe a man-made disaster, as we've spoken of in different shows
mm-hmm.
before. And then there has been several, it seems to me that there's been tsunamis down through the millennia. And then, of course, there, you know, like I'm saying, these land bridges disappeared about 3,000 years ago. So we can even assume that there was absolutely massive upheavals, even about 2,000 to 3,000 years B.C. And this is proven now where there was a tsunami in northern Scotland off the coast of Scandinavia called the Storega. Stor is a word in Scandinavian meaning large or big. And believe me, it was big enough to sink the remainder of these land bridges so that you don't see them anymore. So that was even as recent as 3,000 years ago. There was atomic blasts from the sky that have now been recorded about 11,000 years ago. We've just got information this week on that. You know, the Indus Valley, the rivers dried up there around 13,000 years ago, causing untold devastation.
Oh, my gosh. What do they What do they think happened? A comet? I mean, an asteroid blew up or a meteor blew up?
The official story is that it was a celestial disaster. You know, my work, of course, takes a little bit different slant on that and goes into this question about the planet Tiamat.
Yes.
That used to be a twin of our sun that was destroyed, etc. You know, so but the fact of the matter is, just even from a purely geological point of view, the evidence is now coming in thick and fast that something awesome, famines in Northwest. You see these enormous famines that struck ancient Britain and also the Scandinavian, literally forced these people who could manually cross the land bridges into the continent. Then these are people who spread into the ancient world, into the continent, into Turkey, into Anatolia, down into Greece, and I believe affected and influenced, or maybe even were, the early Proto-Etruscans. You see the Dorians, the Achaeans, the Proto-Greeks, and the Proto-Italians. And it's even rumored now by the people in the know. I mean, Commons Beaumont, one of the great maverick scholars, said it years ago, that even the cave paintings in southern France, these famous cave paintings that have been kept under wraps, he doesn't believe these were done by cave dwellers in France. He believes that these were the artwork of these migrating, traveling, fleeing Northwesterners who were taking refuge in the caves from this age of catastrophe, not from people who lived in caves like our history books have been telling us, which bears no logic at all. How could people who've been living in caves have the sophistication to draw beautiful artistic paintings like that? But it does make sense if these were people who are of a very sophisticated race, taking temporary refuge in deep underground caves because of the kind of cataclysm that we now know hit this world. And just recently, I mean, within the last year, identical images to the ones that are found in these caves like Lascaux in France have been found on the Nile, have been found in Egypt dating to 15,000 years B.C.
Jeez.
So the whole story of cave dwellers in France is completely shot to pieces, like Clint Eastwood has just arrived in town, because this exact same things have been discovered now, you know, in Egypt, and have the same aesthetic appeal and are obviously highly sophisticated. Well, these kinds of conundrums, when you start taking on board this whole west to east movement, it shouldn't shake people up. It's just another page of the ancient history that we're discovering. And so these cultural elements, the music, the language, the religious tropes, the symbolism, now we understand how it moved out into these countries, and later in more historical times would make its journey back again into the West, because at that time, right, in later history,
sure,
the cataclysm had subsided, and now these people, or more correctly their ancestors, their descendants, could now return to the ancestral homes where some semblance of normality had returned.
Michael, tell us again your theories of Tiamat and what happened, because it had a devastating effect on this planet, changed this planet.
That's right. I mean, this is another huge piece. I go into it more in the Atlantis book about the twin sun. It wasn't a sun, it was a huge planet, but it appeared to be a sun, and certainly mythology and now modern science fiction draw upon this fact a lot, that, you know, a sky with two suns, and our system had it. And I believe that this planet, around about 50,000 years ago, was destroyed, and that being mostly a watery planet, the oceans of our planet may in fact be debris from this twin sun that entered into our atmosphere. But one way or another, this destruction of Tiamat has scarred all of the planets of the solar system. I was just discussing this with a gentleman on email recently about the fact that, you see, all the planets of our solar system show signs of enormous attack and catastrophe, not just the fact that there's a whole, you know, asteroid belt up there, etc., but the unbelievable catastrophe, devastation, is known in mythology. It's misinterpreted somewhat. Some people believe in a sort of a twin sun or another planet. Other believe it was more a careering comet that came into our solar system. You know, the debate goes on. But the point is that it had enormous effects for the planet Earth, and it really caused a lot of devastation. I mean, you take away the water from the Pacific Ocean, and what you got there is a huge abyss.
You sure do. Now, this Tiamat problem here, did it merely explode? Did it collide with us? What happened?
Yeah, I believe it did explode massively, and caused all sorts of upheaval. And this is where you read a mythology of our ancestors. You see where the sky turned red and debris fell. You know, you have the story of the sun stopping in the sky. You've got the story of the sun rising in the east, in the west instead of the east. You know, you have all these anecdotes about the, the debris falling from heaven and the wrath of the gods, and just the thunder gods. You know, a lot of our mythology comes from this upheaval. I mean, the expert on this, of course, was the great Immanuel Velikovsky, who looked into all the world's myths and proved that it was because of celestial events that a lot of these gods and goddesses took birth, you know?
Michael, you've done some incredible work into all of this, but let's also talk about some other things that were happening on the planet as well. You've looked at the megalithic hinges and sites in Britain and Europe, and you're trying to put those together. Why?
Well, you see, this was my first awakening into any of this. You know, I grew up in Ireland, you know, and like all Irish people, hadn't the faintest concern or interest with any of, you know, Irish ancient history. You know, we're caught up in whatever rubbish we're caught up in, you know, the normal sectarian, you know, violence and all of this
sure.
kind of thing.
Well, and you can expect that, I guess, huh?
Well, of course you can, you know, and this is what happens when you're completely, you know, manipulated and mind-controlled by whatever's going on in today's world. And it was only the first glimmer. You know, actually, I owe it to a very famous artist, writer called Jim Fitzpatrick, who kindly actually allowed me to use illustrations in the book. This is a great Celtic artist and scholar. But before I came across Jim Fitzpatrick's work, you know, the only way that, you know, this would have ever dawned on me is, like a lot of other people, is looking at the marvels of Stonehenge, looking at the marvels of, you know, Avebury, you see, or Carnac, or Newgrange in Ireland, or Tara. And wondering, my God, you know, could it really have been, you know, unsophisticated people that did this? I mean, can please somebody explain to us why it is that in every single indigenous tribe on the planet, when you go and interview them, they go, oh, no, 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 we're not the sophisticated ones. We're not intelligent. Our ancestors were more sophisticated, more cultured, more, you know, elevated than us. Now, wait a minute, are these people sort of deluded or something? I thought we're taught that all modern people are civilized, but yet every indigenous people tells you, no, 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 no. Our forefathers were the boys with the knowledge.
Now, there
you know, so it's incredible, you know.
There is a reason that this is so important to so many people. And the reason, I think, after looking at the two volumes, talks about the not only the misinterpretation of so many other historians, but that events that occurred then, as you said earlier, have truly affected all of us today when we talk about control and the Illuminati mm-hmm. and these groups that have just done some incredibly awful things to us, Michael.
Exactly. You know, this book is dedicated to the continuing exposure of these organizations, you know, whose ancestry and roots go very far back in time. They're certainly not people, you know, who've... I mean, we've got to understand that this... this war of Armageddon, you know, it takes many forms. Yes, it takes physical attack. It's basically an act of colonialization, as we know, empire building, whatever, you know, you want to call it from a political point of view.
Greed.
But yes, but the original kind of colonialization or colonization is of the mind of human beings. This is a psychic war, ultimately. I mean, it does, as I say, take other permutations, political, militaristic, economic, etc., even into the gender world, you know, in all sorts of ways that it takes. And, you know, we have to understand that primarily, though, this attack on the human race that I believe is age-old is absolutely a war on the psyche, first and foremost. It's a war on who man is. It's also a war on the roots of who we are, because if you can, you know, disconnect a man from his roots, then you have basically the perfect slave.
And destroy his psyche, he's yours. He's putty.
Exactly. You know, the writer Milan Kundera, he said that the struggle of man against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. So, you know, in an American context, you know, we have to fight this war of amnesia because, and I see a great awakening happening where people are starting to understand it. You know, it's absolutely crucial to realize that we have to find out who we are. We've been disconnected from our roots. And this is a slow, gradual, incremental war of attrition from those who are the masters of the world system. Now, so therefore, it's also a slow, gradual, incremental, you know, gaining of knowledge and insight as your eyes become accustomed to the darkness so that you can see what on earth is going on. You've been blinded. These people call themselves Illuminati because they're busy working with light as a weapon against the human race. There's properties of light that we don't understand, manipulative, you know, the science of light. And there's a reason why this term Illuminati is used by the power brokers, because it you know, they're blinding us in a certain particular way. And therefore, in that state of blindedness, we're not seeing ourselves, we're not seeing reality, we're not seeing the world as it really is. And this process is going on, and we're in the latter days of it. This is a very serious, you know, this book is certainly born out of love for my own country, George. I mean, you know, being Irish and everything like that, you know, and I do love my country and I love my history of my country, but I also understand the deep connections between my country of Ireland and America. It's also born out of love for America to see that this country is now under attack by these same, you know, forces, these royal dynasties of Europe that need to be exposed. Their origins need to be exposed. And just like it says on the back of the book, okay, these guys are always telling you in their symbolism and in their various writings that they adore the sun and they adore light. They even refer to themselves, you see, as Luciferians or as Illuminati. Okay, I turn around and say, okay, if you love the sun and you love light so much, how do you feel when we turn that light on you?
Yeah.
How are you going to feel when we turn the light you claim to love, the sunlight, the sun of truth, we turn back on you?
They're not going to like that.
Yeah, and shine up some of your dirty little shadows here so that we can see your face. And we are now in the age, like we said at the beginning of the show, we haven't had this opportunity before, so there's no point getting pessimistic about fate and the way the world is. People should be jumping for joy. You know, I always insist that we should not be pessimistic about what's going on in the world. We should be jumping for joy. I take a page out of, you know, Bo Greitz's book and just say we should be happy about the times we're living in, because our forefathers didn't have a chance to get their mind around this bigger picture on the box. We do. So there should be nothing except unbelievable optimism, unbelievable passion, no sense of fear or trepidation. The American people are a great people. They can be pushed only so far. And they need to arm themselves with knowledge, arm themselves with the history of this Leviathan, this incredible, you know, machinery of tyranny against truth. It can be exposed as it is now being exposed. But people, you know, people guest on your show, shows like yours, and the work that we are doing. So this is a book that is a testament to America. It's a testament to Ireland, to the deep connections between those countries. But even though it's about Ireland, the information in this book can be translated to any nation, to any culture, to any rebellious movement who, you know, has that spirit of rebellion, that spirit of a contradiction, to get up and, you know, fall in love with that word no and say no. You know, it's like the movie Network. You know, I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
By Howard Beale. Yep.
Yeah, we have to have that Howard Beale mentality and not get bought like, unfortunately, Howard Beale got bought, not be corporatized, not be institutionalized, and not let these people fight against the spirit of individuality. We need to be able to put our petty differences aside so that we can save the most precious thing of all, which is independence, the independent mind, the free mind. This is what America is all about, and it's Fabian enemies who realize that they got their ass kicked when they tried to take America by force.
And
did not just disappear over there back to, you know, Britain and Europe. They conspired to continue the process through economic and other means, you see, to bring America to its knees. And this keeps me hot under the collar and needs to be exposed, the whole machinations of this. And that's what this book goes into, the origins of these secret societies and the ideologies that they are, you know, sworn to defend. Because now is the time to shine the light they say they love on them.
Jordan Maxwell would be hugging you for the work in these books.
Well, you know, it's funny because he gave us a wonderful, you know, testimonial. And
yep.
Again, the book is partly dedicated to him. And, you know, when I got to America, I had put a lot of this Irish knowledge behind me. It wasn't something that it was on the forefront of my mind, you know, even though I'd studied all my life. And what happens? I bump into Jordan and he starts talking about the Druids.
And that's exactly my next question. But tell us the Jordan Maxwell story.
Well, I couldn't believe my ears, you know, that here's an American guy. Standing
he's
up, talking about the world conspiracy, and the next thing you know, he's talking about that Christianity, you know, owes a debt to Druidism, that Judaism does, and here's how the Druidic elements permeated, you see, into Judaism and into Christian. I couldn't believe it, that here's an American who knows more about my country than I know, and he understood how this whole question of the ancient Druids fits in. And of course, when I personally got to know him, then, you know, he has voluminous knowledge about this, and he was one of these people I'm telling you about that said, Michael, you know, and you can't just be ranting on about this stuff in your classes, you know, verbally. Write it down. This is amazing. You know, you've got to put this whole story down. And I said, we've got to get the Atlantis book done first, because this I have to sketch in the background. Before you can start talking about the world as moved up to the present day, the rise of Egypt, the migrations of the people from the Northwest, you know, before you can get into all of this, I had to put in the background of the pre-Diluvian, you know, ancient past, sketch in what was happening with Atlantis and Lemuria, because you can't make sense of these cultures until you understand that Atlantis and Lemuria existed.
Why did they carry this through, Michael? Why didn't this obsession for a power grab just end? It just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Because they're psychopathic, and we have to understand that. Oh, no, I'm serious. I mean, see, the people who control the world, who want to control human minds, who, see, the Druids are people who wanted to rule the world because they were morally very pure, and they were able to lead mankind and their societies for the right. Yes, they did execute, you know, their criminals. Yes, they did execute people who broke the law. But these were rulers of society that were deeply spiritual human beings who had, they had rights for women that they say Cleopatra would have admired, you know. But the other side, this ancient dragon court of the Nephilim, these are people who don't even belong on our planet. They had no right to assume worldly terrestrial power. They did so. Their ancestors are still existing today. And their world is a world of power, not love. There's no way of changing them. They have the same relationship to power.
All right, stay with us, Michael. We're at the top of the hour, and we'll be right back with you with our guest, Michael Tesserian. This work is called The Irish Origins of Civilization. Hey, if we're lucky, we'll get a hold of Jordan Maxwell, Michael, to sit in and chat with us as well. We'll be back in a moment.